The views expressed on the following program are the views of the show's host and do not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station, their management, their donors, their underwriters, nor their seventh-born sons. Broadcasting from our secret underground studio in Olympia, Washington, it is time for the Thunderbolts. Yes, kids, there you were, enjoying your privileged white status, blissfully ignorant of the fact that your shoes were manufactured by a child slave, until one day you turned on your radio and you were struck by the Thunderbolt! Hello, Cascadia! It's time to wake up! Yes, you better grab that cup of coffee, because you are about to be struck by the thunderbolt of truth and justice. Here it comes. Yes, kids, the thunderbolt is your guide to activism in Thurston County. I have news. I have commentary, I have a calendar for activist-related events, kick-ass music, and dumb jokes! So Cascadia is off of the couch and into the streets! It's time to save civilization from fiery apocalypse! Though even the apocalypse is gonna have to wait until I have had a cup of coffee!
Enemies are innovative and resourceful, and so are we. They never stop thinking about new ways to harm our country and our people, and neither do we.
What would you do with a brain if you had one?
Tonight on CNN, Anderson Cooper examines a nation in turmoil with a giant panel of ill-informed dumb people talking over each other from behind an enormous gleaming glass and stainless steel horseshoe-shaped desk, while swirling graphics you can't quite read float in the background behind their yammering, gape-jawed heads. Find out what our panelists are thinking all at once as the occasional good point gets drowned out by a cacophony of paid partisan pundits.
Than you ever have in your little
plus, Anderson takes us behind the scenes with a tour inside Gloria Borger's massive mouth. Anderson Cooper presents a clamor of conflicting opinions and insipid interjected analysis from a cabal of caterwauling cognoscente. Tonight at 9, following CNN Tonight with Drunk Don Lemon.
All right, that was our CNN promo.
Wow. Aren't you glad you have the Thunderbolt? Yes, it's September 6th, 2019. And here's what I'm thinking of this week.
I'm thinking of a number.
Since the fact doesn't seem to be very widely advertised, I would like to first point out that empirical scientific studies have now definitively proven that there are absolutely no differences between the human races when it comes to things like intelligence, or capability, or ambition, or any other measure that actually matters. The only differences between the human races are literally skin deep. All other differences are culturally implanted. Provided with the same opportunities and in the same context, African Americans and Asians and Hispanics and Native Americans would perform just as well or just as poorly as white people do. So the heyday of white middle-class home ownership started right after World War II and ended during the Reagan era. If you were a middle-class white person wanting to take advantage of the many opportunities to purchase a home through federal government programs during this era, then it was literally illegal for you to move into an integrated neighborhood. And it was literally illegal for black people to purchase homes in the new, quote, suburbs, unquote, that were created by these government programs. This led to white people fleeing the cities and leaving the inner city to black people, whereupon the inner cities were subsequently left to rot. All of the public monies for schools and roads and services were now out in the suburbs. Black real estate was, of course, worth far less than white real estate. And there were numerous laws, policies, and practices specifically designed to make sure that their properties stayed that way. Now, since I personally consider reparations to African Americans and Native Americans in particular, but to several other groups as well, to be an absolutely vital part of an absolutely vital healing process that this nation very direly needs to engage in as soon as possible. And thus, I am greatly heartened by the fact that reparations are actually being debated in the other Washington. And yes, there is all of the usual ignorance and racism involved in these debates, such as that displayed by the Senate Majority Leader, whom I will not hear name, calling ridiculous the idea of paying for crimes that were committed 160 years ago. As if all of the brutal oppression had somehow just stopped 160 years ago. But actually, in the case of black people, the Emancipation Proclamation merely transformed de jure slavery into de facto slavery. Meaning, they merely traded one form of slavery for another. These new forms of slavery were called things like sharecropping and Jim Crow and vagrancy and so on and so forth. And in many ways, these new forms were even worse than the actual de jure slavery. Because at least during the heyday of slavery, a strong young slave was worth the equivalent of several tens of thousands of dollars. A slave was a very valuable commodity, and he was usually treated as such. Cotton was America's number one cash export from the founding of the country until the 1930s. And black people did most of the hard work to make that happen. At first, as de jure slaves, and then later, as de facto slaves. During the first half of the 19th century, slaves themselves represented the single most valuable commodity in the United States. And all of the richest people in the country lived not in industrial Boston, but in the Mississippi Valley.
If you've enjoyed listening to this record, you'll enjoy Folk Songs of the Spanish Inquisition.
Knees up, Mother Brown. Knees up, Mother Brown. Knees up, don't get the knees up, Mother Brown. That's right. Knees up, Mother, must keep up. You must be careful what you do, you fool.
As with most successful livestock breeders and livestock, was exactly the legal status of slaves at the time. Slave masters kept their herd well-fed, healthy, happy, and reproducing. Yes, there were notable exceptions to that rule, and none of those facts in any way whatsoever mitigates or justifies anything. But after emancipation, a black man's life soon thereafter became worth next to nothing. If the local powers that should not be needed some slave labor, they could simply round up and arrest a bunch of black men on some pretext and then put them to work. The local powers that should not be thus still got their free labor, but now they were no longer responsible for their health or their upkeep outside the prison, and they were no longer responsible for the non-producing family members, quote unquote. Segregation was illegal until the 1960s. But again, even though legal segregation was ended in the 1960s, we merely traded de jure segregation for de facto segregation. Our country is still very thoroughly segregated in housing, in education, in culture, in worldview, and in pretty much every other way imaginable. Over the centuries, blacks and Native Americans in particular, but along with other notable groups, such as Chinese, Irish, Italians, Jews, many others, have been beaten, lynched, raped, burned, legally oppressed, treated as third-class citizens, denied the right to vote, denied the right to marry white people, denied education, and most importantly, they have been deprived of the ability to accumulate wealth. The equivalent of many trillions of dollars with a T have been stolen from blacks and Native Americans in particular over the centuries. And this theft and even more importantly, the intentional deprivation for any opportunity to ever accumulate any actual wealth for those groups thereafter. This was a systemic effort that was not conducted with the enthusiastic support of the United States government. It was instead conducted largely at the insistence of the United States government. Their official written policy at the time not only encouraged segregation, but they actually made desegregation illegal in any government-funded housing programs. The official underwriting manual of the Federal Housing Administration at the time stated that, quote, incompatible racial groups should not be permitted to live in the same communities. Most of these policies were, in fact, codified and strictly enforced by the Federal Housing Administration. And the infamous term redlining also came into being during this period, when the federal government began drawing color-coded maps of every metropolitan area. Those maps were first used by the Homeowners Loan Corporation, then the Federal Housing Administration, and then even the Veterans Administration. These color codes were designed to indicate where it was safe to insure mortgages. And anywhere that African Americans lived, or even anywhere that African Americans lived near, these neighborhoods were color-coded red to indicate to appraisers that they were too, quote, risky to insure mortgages. The underwriting manual of the Federal Housing Administration also recommended that highways would be a good way to separate African Americans from white neighborhoods. It is also important to understand that this was not a matter of a law, but a matter of regulation. But since it wasn't hidden, it cannot be claimed that this was some kind of de facto situation, as regulations published in the underwriting manual are as much a de jure unconstitutional violation as something that is actually written into law. Public housing was yet another example of how government policy set out to ensure segregated cities. Believe it or not, at first, public housing was meant to be an affirmative action program for white people. During the Depression, there was virtually no housing construction going on, since middle class and working class families were losing their homes when they became unemployed, and so there were many white families in dire need. And this was the constituency that the federal government wanted to help. And thus, they began a program of building whites-only public housing in cities across the country. They also built a few projects for African Americans as well. But those were, of course, completely segregated. The problems arose when the white projects started having large numbers of vacancies, while the black projects began experiencing long waiting lists. Eventually, that fact became so conspicuous that the public housing authorities and the federal government opened up the white designated projects to black people. This happened at the same time that industry was leaving the cities and blacks were becoming poorer in those areas, and the projects were thus transformed into projects for poorer people rather than for working class people, and they then became subsidized when they had not been subsidized previously, and thus transformed into a welfare program. And that was how the inner cities were eventually converted into the slums that we have come to associate with public housing today. And here is another very important fact that everyone involved in the reparations debate needs to be aware of. Today, African American incomes, on average, are about 60% of white incomes. Yet actual African American wealth is only 5% that of whites. Now that insane paradigm a direct result of these very intentional policies that were implemented by our federal government. Most of the middle-class families in this country gain their wealth from the equity that they have in their homes. And this enormous difference between a 60% income ratio and a 5% wealth ratio is almost entirely attributable to federal housing policy implemented throughout the 20th century, and especially with the New Deal and the related post-war economic boom that was largely generated by middle-class white people spending all of the money that they were making during that period. African-American families were legally prohibited from buying homes in the suburbs in the 1940s and the 1950s, and even into the 1960s. And thus, they garnered none of the equity appreciation that middle-class white people were able to pass on to their children. And yet another thing about all this is that all of these homes middle-class white people were buying in the late 40s and 50s sold at about twice the national median income and were thus affordable to working-class families with an FHA or a VA mortgage. At that time, African Americans were also able to afford those homes. But as mentioned, black people were legally prohibited from purchasing them. And today, those homes sell for 6 to 8 times the national median income. Meaning that while black families could have afforded them back in the day, by the time housing discrimination was made, quote, illegal, unquote, meaning the end of de jure segregation, those homes were now no longer affordable to the families that could have afforded them when all of those white people were buying into those suburbs. Or the beginning of de facto segregation. And thus, blacks completely missed out upon the opportunity to garner all of the equity and all of the wealth that followed from all of that home buying that was going on during that period. Those white families sent their children to college with those home equities. The white working class of that generation was not only able to take care of their own parents in old age, but they were also able to bequeath wealth to their children rather than depending upon those children and or upon welfare and or upon Social Security when they retired. Whilst none of those advantages accrued to any of several oppressed racial minority groups. No, Mr. Senate Majority Leader, the crimes did not stop in 1864, and we owe them a hell of a lot more than whatever token pittance the politicians are considering putting on the table. So just think of how much boomier that boom would have been had African Americans and Native Americans and Hispanic Americans also been allowed to generate the many contributions that they could have made outside of a performance stage or a sports arena. For you see, that is the thing about oppression. The loss of all that potential costs all of us. It's time for a quick station break now. So don't worry, the Thunderbolt will soon return. Or maybe you should worry about that. See you in a minute. The views expressed on the Thunderbolt are my views, and no one else's. Those views do not necessarily reflect the views of any of the stations that air the Thunderbolt, nor anybody that has anything to do with any of those stations. And now, back to the Thunderbolt.
I'm from the Australian government. Do you have something to hide? Nah, just kidding. We're not some fascist regime. Seriously though, do you? Unfortunately, encryption makes it hard for us to spy on you these days. So just to make sure, we're introducing yet another law to expand the surveillance state. Introducing the Assistance and Access Bill, or ASACCESS for short. Oh, relax. Despite how it sounds, we're not trying to access your data through your back door. We're just after the keys to your front door. Yep, ASACCESS will force tech companies to do our dirty work for us. For example, by making them insert a little secret sauce in their apps, which lets us access your device once you download the latest update. And if they refuse, we'll find the shit out of them. ASACCESS. It doesn't break encryption, only your trust in your favourite apps. To bring you ASACCESS, we've taken the UK's fascist spying law and made it even more fascist by removing any need for judicial oversight. But don't worry, we promise to only spy on you if reasonable and proportionate. And you know you can trust us. We're the same cunts who doxed a welfare recipient for criticising us, who are prosecuting a whistleblower for exposing our misconduct, who throw kids in concentration camps for seeking asylum, and prosecute the journalists who report on them, and who gave $500 million of your tax dollars to a foundation full of our friends. So of course you can count on us to be reasonable and proportionate. And if we're not, well, you'll never hear about it. Because we've also introduced a 10-year jail sentence for any Snowden wannabes who disclose our abuse of ASACCESS. ASACCESS. Brought to you by Australia, where the laws of dickheads can't trump the laws of math, but they can trample human rights. Which is why to test this shit fuckery, we chose Australia, the weakest of the Five Eyes Alliance, thanks to our lack of a Bill of Rights. So international data requests will now be funneled through us, compromising not just Aussies, but all of you fuckers too. You're welcome. We'd love to know what you think of ASACCESS, so we've set up a public submission system where for a limited time, you can protest our next step towards a fucked up dystopia. Australian government. Relax, we're not after your dick pics, just the last shreds of your civil liberties. Authorised by the Department of Home Affairs.
Pairs. All right, and we're back. So in the first half of the show, we covered racism. Let's start off the second half with sexism. It turns out that female Uber drivers make 7% less per hour than male Uber drivers do. Right. And if that fact actually surprises anyone, then said surprise is probably due to how small that pay gap is compared to the overall population at large. Especially since several members of the upper Uber management recently had their asses handed to them by Me Too, who sent those sexually predatory asses packing. Well, it turns out that in this case, that gender pay gap is not Uber's fault. Now, that doesn't mean that Uber is actually really nice, or that you would want your daughter dating Uber, but we cannot be laying false blame even upon such a deserving target. And it turns out that Uber's dispatch system is literally gender neutral. Neither the computers nor the dispatchers know the gender of any given driver. In addition, since Uber drivers are famously non-unionized, then that pay is the same for all Uber drivers, based strictly upon their performance. And that pay is not negotiated, which means that Uber's pay system is also gender neutral. So what's up with that pay gap? Since large-scale gender-neutral systems are so rare, researchers eagerly descended upon Uber's numbers and records and researched that very question. And here's what they came up with. About a quarter of that pay gap is due to the fact that men work in the more lucrative areas of town. And part of that fact is due to the related fact that yet another quarter of that pay gap is due to the fact that there is much more turnover amongst female drivers than there is for male drivers. And the more experience that an Uber driver has, then the more tricks and shortcuts they learn, including the ability of figuring out where the better paying areas of town are. And thus they tend to become much more efficient with their time. And third, this fact is going to make misogynistic sexists the world over celebrate and rejoice. Fully half of that pay gap is due to the fact that men simply drive faster and more aggressively than women do, and thus get there faster. And yet, in spite of that, women still get into more accidents per mile than men do. And so, the woman driver stereotype turns out to have a little more substance than just some baseless, sexist bullshit. So I guess I will need to add that to my short list of things wherein men are superior to women. For instance, men are better than women at being boy toys. Men are better at retrieving things from tall shelves, And men are better at kicking people's asses. And now, evidently, men are also better drivers than women are. That's all I've come up with so far, though. In pretty much all other fields, us dudes had probably still better watch our backs, or I suspect that we're likely to become somewhat evolutionarily irrelevant sometime in some not-so-distant future generation. In 1988, the National Rainbow Gathering of the Tribes was held in Southeast Texas. Now, I had been to Southeast Texas. Texas, in fact, has a rather legendary place in my personal reality, in that after having traveled all over North America more times than I can count, with the notable exception of Austin, I consider the entire state of Texas to be my very favorite place in the whole world to not be. I was not the only one to predict that if the gathering were held in Texas, the Texans would start shooting hippies. However, in 1988, the United States Forest Service pulled out all the stops to stop the Rainbow Gathering. I attended the seed camp that year, and there were more Texas state troopers at the seed camp than there were hippies. However, there were also more reporters at the seed camp than there were hippies. For as a result of our epic battle, we were front page news in every newspaper in Texas for the entire month of June that year. And as a result of all this publicity, what the locals saw was us standing right up to the feds and spitting in their eye. And it turns out that Texans evidently hate feds even more than they hate hippies, because they were loving our shite. I personally saw one local, complete with a 10-gallon cowboy hat and rhinestone-encrusted cowboy boots, get right into the faces of the state police at one of their roadblocks, asking them, "Where the hell is your Texas hospitality? These folks are our visitors. Didn't your mama teach you any manners?" So I have attended 13 National Rainbow Gatherings, and never have the locals been more warm-hearted, friendlier, more generous, and more supportive than those people in Texas were. So most of you probably have a stereotype of Tea Partiers and Trump supporters. I suspect that while it would certainly be possible to find representational examples of such stereotypes, I also suspect that on the whole, many of those people might surprise you. I actually attended two Tea Party rallies during their heyday. The first was attended mostly by working people who seemed more scared than angry, and I had a lot of very interesting conversations with several of them, and I think I even opened a few eyes of a couple of folks that had been seeking some answers that made sense. The second Tea Party rally I attended, though, reminded me of a 5-minute hate from the novel 1984. It was a bunch of angry white suits screaming hatred and bigotry and blaming school teachers and unions for all of our ills. the Tea Party was eventually bought and paid for, but especially at first, there was actually a massive grassroots push behind it. And I suspect that we have a lot more in common with a lot of Tea Partiers, as well as a lot of Trump supporters, than either side realizes. And it would be really good if we could all get together and work together against our common enemy. So that's it for the news and commentary section this week. And that means it's time to get to work. And I have a jam-packed calendar that barely fit this week, so we're going to get right to it here. But first of all, I need to tell you that I am taking something of a working vacation. What this means is that while I will be posting shows from the archive for the rest of the month, this week will be the last Thunderbolt calendar that I will be producing until the October 4th show. And so for the rest of September, everyone in Seattle and Olympia will be hearing the same show. So, on with this week's calendar. This first event isn't actually happening until Sunday, September 15th, but this is a bus trip and they need advanced registration. And in addition, this is that working vacation I mentioned, as there is going to be a major conference in Detroit to start networking various grassroots organizations all over across the country, which is exactly the strategic thing we need to be doing right now. And it so happened they needed a bus driver for this trip, and it so happens that I am a bus driver, and it so happens that I am in dire need of a vacation right about now, and so here we go. This will be a bus traveling from Olympia to the Congress of Municipal Movements in Detroit. The bus will be leaving Olympia on September 15th and returning on September 25th. You can get more information about the conference at symbiosis-revolution.org and then click on the 2019 Congress tab. And there is a link here to where you can sign up for the Olympia bus, but it's one of those Google Doc addresses. It's half a paragraph long, and I'm not going to read it. You can probably reach us through the website, I'm thinking, or you can send me an email, and I get my email out at the end of the show. So again, there will be a big crown bus traveling from Olympia to the Congress of Municipal Movements in Detroit, leaving Olympia September 15th and returning on September 25th. So our first event on the regular calendar is today, Saturday, September 7th. In fact, if you're listening to Free Radio Olympia, this is happening right now, and you should get over there because this is the Co-op Harvest Party. This will be from noon to 4 p.m., and it's at West Central Park, which is at 1919 Harrison Avenue Northwest, or on the corner of Harrison and Division. And while I have been engaged in a fairly serious conflict with a handful of staff members at the Olympia Food Co-op for a while now, the co-op itself is still one of the most awesome institutions in our community, and this event is a potluck with live music that includes a whole bunch of the best food you've ever eaten. And you should go. Anyway, this event was organized by the Olympia Food Co-op, and this is their message. We are celebrating the bounty of the harvest season with our friends and neighbors. Enjoy food, music, games, and prizes with us at the beautiful West Central Park. So again, this is the Co-op Harvest Party, Saturday, September 7th, from noon to 4 p.m. at the West Central Park, 1919 Harrison Avenue, Northwest. Also today, Saturday, September 7th, we have an event called Flexible Farming, Adapting to a Changing Climate. This will be from 3 to 5:30 p.m. at the Urban Futures Farm. The address there is 928 Wilson Street, Northeast. And this event was organized by the Thurston Conservation District, and this is their message. With the help of Thurston CD and the Rural Energy Development for Washington program, Urban Futures Farm is implementing solutions to increase their resiliency to a changing climate. Come learn about climate smart farming practices and funding opportunities, including solar panel installation, energy efficiency practices, integrated pest management, and cover cropping. There is also a voluntary stewardship program workshop. Educators will share information about available renewable energy and energy efficiency options and talk you through some of the incentives and grants that are available to help implement projects on your own small farm or small business. Please RSVP to Nora White, and you can do that by sending an email to nwhite@thurstoncd.com. That's nwhite@thurstoncd.com, or telephoners can telephone 360-754-3588, extension 105. Again, that's 754-3588, extension 105. So again, this is Flexible Farming, Adapting to a Changing Climate, Saturday, September 7th, 3 to 5:30 p.m. at the Urban Futures Farm, 928 Wilson Street, Northeast. The next event is not only also today, Saturday, September 7th, but if after the Urban Future Farms event, you still want to continue farming out, you can head over to Grub, because they're also having their harvest soiree over there. This will be from 4 to 8 p.m. at Alvey's Garden Parties. That address is 4127 20th Lane, Northwest. I'll repeat that in a minute. This event was organized by Grub, and this is their message. Please join us for our annual farm-to-table feast celebrating delicious and local produce, beverages, and craft foods. This event includes live music, silent and live auctions featuring local art, culinary delights, West Coast adventures, and more. Have a lovely evening and support a great cause. And this is a 21 and older event. There is a website here where you can RSVP. It's tinyurl.com/grubsoireeticket. Grub is G-R-U-B, Grub Soiree Ticket. Or you can call 360-753-5522. So again, this is Grub's 2019 Harvest Soiree, Saturday, September 7th, from 4 to 8 p.m. at Albee's Garden Parties, 4127 20th Lane, Northwest. All right. Our next event is Monday, September 9th. It's the Detention Lottery, an immersive theater experience. Sounds interesting. This will be from 7 to 9 p.m., and it's at Temple Bet Hatpilo, I believe is how you say that, 201 8th Avenue Southeast. That's by the Timberland Library. This event was organized by Temple Bet Hatpilo, and this is their message. People will be joining us for a staged reading of this dynamic and deeply moving play based upon the experiences of Seattle immigration attorneys. It is set in a U.S. detention center. Parental discretion is advised as this performance is geared to age 12 and up. Free admission, donations support the Advocates for Immigrants and Detention Northwest. Their website is aidnw.org. So again, this is the Detention Lottery, an immersive theater experience, Monday, September 9th, 7 to 9 p.m. at Temple Beth Hatfilo, 201 8th Avenue Southeast. So next on the agenda is Tuesday, September 10th, Lighting the Way with Community Solar. This will be from 5:30 to 8 p.m. at the Banquet Room of the Olympia Center. That's at 222 Columbia Street Northeast. This event was organized by the Northwest Eco Building Guild, and this is their message. Join Olympia Community Solar and the Northwest Eco Building Guild for an educational session discussing and networking about community solar projects. A new nonprofit venture, Olympia Community Solar, will share their unique collaborative ownership model that provides access to solar energy and its benefits to people across different income brackets. Doors open at 5:30, program begins at 6. Snacks and light refreshments will be served. It's free for members. Guest suggested donation is $10. So again, this is the Lighting the Way with Community Solar, Tuesday, September 10th, 5:30 to 8 p.m. at the Olympia Center, 222 Columbia Street, Northeast. And next is Wednesday, September 11th. It's Heroes for Housing, number 6. This will be from 7:45 to 9 a.m. early in the morning at South Puget Sound Community College, 2011 Mottman Road, Southwest. And Mottman is spelled M-O-T-T-M-A-N. And this event was organized by Homes First, and this is their message. People will be joining our community and supporting real brick-and-mortar rental homes for low-income households in Thurston and in Mason counties. At our one and only fundraiser, we will inspire you with stories from our tenants and the impact on our community of having safe, healthy, and affordable homes can change lives. And I have no contact information other than a Facebook event. So again, this is Heroes for Housing, number 6. Wednesday, September 11th, from 7:45 to 9 a.m. at the South Puget Sound Community College, 2011 Mottman Road, Southwest. Also on Wednesday, September 11th, we have an event called What's Up with Climate Change, looking locally at impacts. This will be from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Olympia Center, 222 Columbia Street, Northwest. This event was organized by the Deschutes Estuary Restoration Team, and this is their message. Introducing our next community forum, What's Up with Climate Change? What climate impacts should we expect to see in the South Sound and Bud Inlet? How will sea level rise, ocean acidification, and warming waters impact our marine life, downtown, and cultural resource harvest in the area? How does estuary restoration play into all this? What can we do? Join the conversation with free pizza from the Blue Heron Bakery. So again, this is What's Up with Climate Change, looking locally at the impacts, Wednesday, September 11th, 6 to 8 p.m. at the Olympia Center, 222 Columbia Street, Northwest. And then next comes Thursday, September 12th. We have a film screening called Damned to Extinction. This will be from 7 to 10 p.m. at the Capitol Theater, 206 Fifth Avenue Southeast. This event was organized by Save Our Wild Salmon, and this is their message. People will be joining us for this important film that tells the story of orca scientists, local citizens, tribal members, and others who have been working to protect orca by restoring the salmon that they depend on. The doors open at 6:30, the film screening starts at 7, and at 8 there will be a post-screening discussion. You can learn more and view a preview at DammedToExtinction.com. And you can also go to the Film Society's website, which is OlympiaFilmSociety.org. So again, this is a film screening of Damned to Extinction, Thursday, September 12th, from 7 to 10 p.m. at the Capitol Theater, 206 Fifth Avenue Southeast. And that is it for the calendar. That is it for the Thunderbolt. We'll see you next week.
Thank you very much.